knife.
Is that the sound of your iPod on fire?
Close. Very close. You're almost correct.
What was that?
That is some people who call themselves the Haters.
Mm-hmm.
And the name of the track is Fire 21.
I wonder what 1 through 20 were like.
It's been a long time since the days of the Decapods.
Yes.
People who've been listening to the show.
Long time listeners will recall the Decapod.
Will recall the lovely day of the Decapods. I just wanted to kind of, you know, bring back the spirit of the Decapods.
Absolutely.
In the opening theme. Music.
Music. So this is Linoleum Knife, a program about movies.
And interesting musical selections.
Absolutely.
It is also a program about that.
No question.
As opening theme, music.
Yes.
Yes.
You are Dave White.
I'm Dave White.
For movies.com.
Yes. You're Alonzo Duralde of therap.com and whattheflicknot.com, even though it's on the internet.
YouTube.com/whattheflickshow, one word, if you're looking for it.
And I almost played something else. It's my week. I didn't want to, you know.
Can you turn up my headphones a little? I can barely hear anything.
What am I doing?
Turn up my headphones a little bit, please.
All right.
More? Thank you. That's good.
That's good.
Right there. All right. Yeah. Yes, it was your week to pick music, which everyone knew the second this thing started.
What a show it's already started to become. What a great show it is today.
We're very low energy. What's going on there?
You're low energy. I'm exactly the same amount of energy I always have.
I see. Well, I just had a big glass of iced coffee, so I should be kicking in at any moment now.
I'm ready to begin the rousing discussions.
Great.
Of films. Of films and cinema. What? Alfest is over for you.
Yes.
And so, you've been sleeping a lot, which may account for your low energy.
Could be. And I have not been sleeping nearly enough, frankly. When you woke me up this morning at 10,
at 10 a.m.,
which is shockingly late for me, I could have slept another hour. I was still fully...
Do you want to go back to sleep right now and let me handle this show all by myself?
No, I do
not. Tell everyone
not.
What to think and do and see?
I do not.
Because, honestly, I mean, I think you know that...
What do I know?
They're just tuning in for me.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
Uh huh. Yeah.
And, so what do we got this week? We got,
The Wolverine.
Yes.
And Woody Allen's latest Blue Jasmine.
Also that.
Or as Christy put it on the show this week, this year's Woody Allen movie. And The To Do List.
Yeah.
Let's knock that one out first.
You want to just start talking about the to-do list?
Yeah,
right away?
Let's.
All right. So, back in 1997,
mm-hmm.
our friend Sarah Jacobson, the late Sarah Jacobson.
Yes.
And I say the late Sarah Jacobson because she died.
Yes.
She died very young.
Yeah.
In fact. She died at the age of 32
mm-hmm.
of cancer. A quick, undetected cancer that no one knew was coming. She didn't know it was there. They diagnosed her. Boom. It was practically done.
Yeah.
And but before that happened, she made this cool little movie. She made more than one movie. She made, but the one for our purposes right now.
This was her only feature, though, right? Or did she make other features?
I forget. She made Mary Jane's Not a Virgin Anymore.
Yes.
And they played at Sundance.
Yeah, I actually saw it in 96 at the Independent Feature Market. And there was kind of no missing Sarah and her mom. Like, they were really out there pushing the movie, and they had these great stickers that said Not a Virgin.
Yeah.
So they were very popular. Everybody was wearing the Not a Virgin stickers at the market. And so I invited her then to come to the USA Film Festival in April of 97. And in the meantime, she got into Sundance. She played in the, not a competition, it was like in their Spectrum section or whatever, where they sort of added additional American
titles. It was
kind of
midnight shows or something like that.
Not even that. It was like, I think now maybe Next is sort of the equivalent that they have there. They're always changing the categories there. But it was basically for American films, not a competition, but new filmmakers they wanted to spotlight, yada, yada, yada.
Right.
And so then, yeah, then she came to Dallas, and that's when you met her.
Right. And so she came to show the movie, and we hung out and became friends and listened to records.
Right.
And she made this movie about a young teenage girl who learns to take her sexual pleasure into her own, you know...
Control. Not into her own hands.
That sounds like something else. Exactly. And by the end of the movie, she's got, you know, a lover or more than one, and she
knows what she wants, and
knows what she wants, and she gets it. She tells them what they want. She tells them what she wants, and she makes them do it.
Yeah,
and it's a funny movie. It was made for like 35 cents.
Yeah,
like,
totally
made for no money. Shot in a variety of locations in San Francisco. Starring her friends, essentially.
Very, very DIY underground filmmaking.
She wrote it, she directed it, she produced it, she self-distributed it.
Right. Which is why, sadly, you can't get it on DVD now, because heaven only knows who has the...
My understanding is that her mom has DVDs.
Really?
Someone was asking me this on the internet the other day.
Huh.
Because when I presented my to-do... Oh, God. You're low energy, and I'm mouth no energy. I can't speak.
Well, if we can find a link online
When I posted my review, that's what I'm trying to say.
Right.
When I posted my review, a friend said, I can't find this anywhere, but there's someone on IMDb who says that she's Sarah's mother and has copies. So, and I'm assuming that that is Sarah's mom.
Yeah,
still selling the copies.
All right, if we can track that down, we'll post the information on our Facebook page.
It's a really rough film. It's, you know,
it doesn't have a sheen to it. It does. It's not filled with, you know, the soundtrack is not filled with the hit songs you remember of yesteryear,
or the indie darlings that you know of now.
Yeah.
It's a 1997 punk rock movie.
Right.
And when she distributed it, she often would show it in bars and punk rock music venues.
Mm. Although the characters are not like punk rock.
A couple of them are.
Yeah, but like everybody in this movie has a safety pin in their nose.
But I mean, Sarah, God.
I know.
I'm dating safety myself. Pin in the nose.
I'm just trying to explain to you. When you say it's a punk rock movie, they immediately think it's going to be Decline of Western Civilization or something.
No, they don't, because they're not you, and they're not O-100.
I bet you there are people who listen to this show who, if you say something is a punk rock movie, their initial thought is that it's going to be like some early Penelope Spheeris film, and not necessarily that it was made in a quick and dirty kind of style.
Right, yes. Are you done explaining punk rock to the kids, Grandpa?
I'm going to hit you.
No, you ain't. No. I don't even know what I was talking about anymore. She distributed this film outside of the normal venues. That's where I was going.
Okay, yes.
Before you...
I'm just trying...
Before you decided to about safety pins in the nose.
I'm just trying to be clear what we're talking about here.
And the mohawks,
oh,
and the blue eye shadows, and the
leather studded
bracelets, and the the bondage trousers of yore.
People still wear that stuff. It's Los Angeles.
Occasionally,
you see. Yeah,
you know who wears that stuff in Los Angeles?
Teenagers,
57-year-old aging punk rockers who take all of their fashion cues from 1975 England with the safety pin.
Well, I still see 14-year-olds who are like wearing their Misfits shirts and putting gelatin in their hair.
And you're completely taking two different phases of punk rock and now putting them together. Because, once again, you have no idea what you're talking about. So just let me keep telling them about Sarah Jacobson's Mary Jane's Not a Virgin anymore.
Yes, Dave, I'll just shut up because you're the only person who knows anything about the culture.
At this table, yes. Currently, that's me. I'm the one that needs to talk about this right now.
I'm trying to footnote this for people who did not destroy their hearing standing in front of the Marshall stacks at Black Flag shows
in their teen years. I'm capable of telling them that too. You aren't.
God, you're ridiculous.
So anyway,
go sit in a booth with Rodney Bingenheimer and show off your superior knowledge of everything while I do this program.
Are you done?
Go on. Are you? Go on, expert.
Have you accomplished?
Proceed, Madam Full Charge.
Anyway, Mary Jane's Not a Virgin Anymore is a fun little movie.
Yes.
Helped along the way by Tamara Davis.
I believe so,
yes. And by Kim Gordon.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so I remember when Sarah came to Dallas for the first time, she was staying with somebody that she knew from the guy from the movie Slacker.
She was staying with the guy from Slacker, the JFK assassination event, who turns out in real life was a JFK assassination. Yeah. He actually did put out a zine called Conspiracy and Logo.
And she, after one night at his house, she said, "Can I come sleep on your couch?" I said, "Of course you can." And so she did. And I'll always remember that first day that she was in our house. And you said, you were going off to work, and you said, "What are you kids doing today?" And she looked at you, and she said, "We're going to F-ish up."
And that became your mantra.
And then we went to Highland Park Pharmacy and had milkshakes.
Nice.
That was how we did that.
That's how you F-S up.
Yeah, she showed me Heavy Metal Parking Lot for the first time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I had managed not to see it until
1997,
the late 90s. Yeah, she showed that to me, and she was wonderful. And when we would go to San Francisco, and she would always be there. And we helped her, you know, put up flyers and stuff. And she took us to cool clubs, and she was a really wonderful a woman. And
the only reason we bring all of this up is because the to-do list
is the same plot as Mary Jane's Not a Virgin Anymore, except worse.
And it's garbage.
Yeah. Now it's your turn to tell people about what happens in that movie, now that I'm done explaining other things to people.
Oh, lucky me.
Yeah.
Okay, so Aubrey Plaza plays a recently graduated high school student. Let that soak in for a moment, because Aubrey Plaza is
29.
Yeah. Angie Harmon is 20. Okay, so she was a valedictorian, you know, she was little Miss Mathlete, good girl, goody two shoes. Her friends drag her off to a kegger on graduation night. She gets drunk for the first time and winds up making out with sexy surfer dude, and realizes that she has been neglecting her below the belt education. So, type A personality that she is, she decides that she has to do all of the naughty things before she goes off to college. And so she makes this list of things, and she doesn't even know what half of them are, but she sets out she's going to accomplish them. Many of which she does with Johnny Simmons, from her co-star from Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, who has been in love with her all during high school, and she is perfectly happy to totally use physically without ever reciprocating his feelings, because her goal in this is to have sex with the surfer dude. And all three of them work together at a crappy public pool over the summer that is run by Bill Hader. So, you know, she has naughty misadventures and stuff, and it's not funny at all, and the director isn't competent enough to make humiliation comedy not humiliating to Aubrey Plaza, which, you know, there are moments where she gets, like, her top comes off in the pool, everybody mocks her flat chest, and it goes on for a long time.
Yeah.
It's really awkwardly shot and edited into a way that you feel bad for the actress, not just for the character, but for the actress. And, you know, it's set in 1993, so it's just larded with the most obvious song choices. I mean, like, really, if I hear the Spin Doctors' Two Princes in one more 90s period piece movie, I'm going to shoot somebody. It's just lazy and clumsy and not effective and not funny.
It is not dope or fresh or chill.
Not in the slightest. No. As you point out, for a movie that opens with me so horny, it never delivers on
that. I tell you, me so horny. You listen to the words, lyrics to me so horny lately?
When I saw the to-do list, I did, yes.
They are very R-rated lyrics. They are still actually somewhat shocking, the lyrics to me so horny. But that kicks off the movie.
Yeah.
And you really think, okay, well, they're going for it. Here, they're going to... Yeah. This is going to be a movie where, you know, remember how the
that
first
song
time
writes
saw,
a check that they do not cash.
Yeah, remember how in Clerks, it felt like people were saying really horrible, gross sex things for the first time. You know,
true, or at least I mean stuff that you'd heard in life, but never in
you'd the heard movie. In life, but you hadn't heard that kind of language in movies really very often, and certainly not. This endless comedic barrage of nasty things that people were saying to each other.
Right.
This movie doesn't even talk dirty as eloquently and hilariously as Clerks.
No.
And so not only does it not accomplish itself, you know, it doesn't live up to the lyrics of Me So Horny. It doesn't live up to its predecessors in a dialogue, you know, sense. It doesn't come close to the kind of, you know, I don't want to use the word empowerment because it's just a terrible word, but...
equal opportunity.
At the end of Mary Jane's Not a Virgin Anymore, you knew that girl was A, getting laid, and B, getting it like she wanted it.
Right.
With no need to learn lessons
right.
about anything. But here, Aubrey Plaza has to learn a lesson about... You know, oh, sex is so important, and it should be with someone you love,
and friendship, and blah.
And she still isn't really having great sex by the end of the movie. She's just, you know, she's learned a lot from having lots of bad sex.
Right.
Which also happens in Mary Jane.
Yeah.
She has some bad sex.
But all she learns from that is how to
all
have
she
good
learns
sex.
From that is, all she has to learn from that in Mary Jane is... Oh, I'm not ever going to have sex with that guy again because he's stupid. Or I'm going to make him do the right thing
for me. Yeah, I have to ask for what I want. And here's the thing.
And
I mean,
so...
No, go ahead.
Anyway, this film falls short on every level. But the director and writer is married to Bill Hader, who is in the film as the manager of the pool.
And there's an amazing cast of people who I'm sure are all in Bill Hader's phone, you know, because Donald Glover is in it, and Alia Shawkat, and Adam Pally, and Rachel Bilson, and Clark Gregg, and who else?
I don't know. But
a ton of people in
lots
this movie
of
that,
folks,
that are funny, and they're not funny in this because the movie isn't funny. I mean, I'm all for
nepotism.
No, what I was going to say was I'm all for
because I am all for nepotism as long as it's handled properly.
Yes, yes. work your context right. But but no, I'm all for like. For sex comedies that are told from a female point of view that are about, I will say empowering, about empowering women to achieve their own orgasms however they need to do it and to do the stuff they want to do. And I like the idea of a female-driven sex comedy being as outrageous and as gross and as shocking as a male-centric sex comedy. And you get that with Mary Jane's Not a Virgin Anymore. You get that with For a Good Time Call, which we both liked.
For a Good Time Call actually makes fun of the bra on sex scene.
Yes.
And the bra on sex scene is a staple of the to-do list.
Right.
And nobody makes a joke about it.
No, never. Yeah. And the thing is, I mean, this is an R-rated comedy.
And there's not even a lot of sex in For a Good Time Call. It's just a lot of filthy talk.
Exactly, yeah. And For a Good Time Call, I mean, The To-Do List is an R-rated movie, and it's so tame when it actually gets to the deed. And there's a few kind of gross-out bodily fluid jokes, but they're so lazy and barely competent that they don't count. Like, they want credit for the fact that she, you know, spits instead of swallows.
Right.
But they don't stage it in a way that's particularly funny or inventive. It's just there, and it's being there is supposed to be the joke.
I kept thinking about all the women in the world that I wish would write and direct a sex comedy.
Such as?
People who aren't even filmmakers.
Oh.
You know, I want Lisa Carver to do that. You know, I want her to somehow get the wherewithal and the cash to do, write a screenplay about, you know, crazy sex lives.
Cintra Wilson.
Yeah. Those are the people I want doing this sort of thing.
Yeah. Not Bill Hader's wife.
Women with some fire.
Yeah.
You know. And those are just the two off the top of my head. But, what a boring, sad movie.
Yeah.
And Gray liked it.
Boy, howdy. Yeah, if you watch this week's What the Flick, Gray takes on me and Christy and Ben. We were all not having it, and she was totally defending it.
She needs to be persecuted for this.
I suspect that part of it has to do with being...
Perhaps like a witch trial.
There you go.
In olden times.
Yes. I think it was one of those things where she was maybe exactly the age of the character. And
it doesn't matter.
No, it shouldn't. But I think that might have made her more inclined to be sort of sentimental or nostalgic about
teen,
it. I don't know.
Teen stuff of the 90s.
Yeah, but ugh, this movie. Boo.
Look, the music I played at the beginning of the show,
uh-huh,
from the 90s.
Hmm.
Yeah. So there was a whole lot of stuff going on in the 90s.
And the dream of the 90s is alive in Portland.
No, it's not. It's alive in my cassette player.
That too.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on.
I just want to also say I'm a huge fan of Aubrey Plaza.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's the other thing. I mean, that's such a
the
waste.
The Daria High School Reunion fake trailer that's up this week
is much
is
funnier,
really funnier
than anything in this movie.
And I wish that was going to be a real movie.
Absolutely. I would be first in line for that. No, I thought she was great last year in Safety Not Guaranteed. I enjoy her on Parks and Rec. But yeah, this movie drags everyone down.
Yep.
Okay, Blue Jasmine.
Blue Jasmine.
Why don't you talk about what it's about?
I was fixing to put a piece of Nutella bread in my mouth away from the microphone, of course.
Of course.
I wasn't going to eat into the microphone.
I know, you would never, ever.
Jasmine, whose real name is Jeanette, mm-hmm, played by Cate Blanchett, she has been a very rich lady and has lost everything. Because her husband, Alec Baldwin, is a criminal financial guy.
Jasmine is played by Cate Blanchett.
That's what I said.
Did you?
Yep.
Okay.
Someone's not paying attention to me.
I mean, when you start talking, I tend to tune
in. Yeah, apparently, yeah. So that's your first bit of... that's your first clue that this movie is completely fantasy land. That someone in the financial sector got punished and sent to prison.
Well, Bernie Madoff
for their crimes.
That only happens if you screw over other rich people.
Okay.
That's why Bernie Madoff went to jail.
I see. So Alec Baldwin's character gets caught, sent to prison, and she loses everything, almost everything. She somehow manages still to fly first class from New York to San Francisco to visit her estranged sister, played by Sally Hawkins.
They were both adopted.
And she manages to hold on to her Louis Vuitton luggage and her Chanel outfits and her Hermes bag. But everything else is gone. She has no money.
Government seized all of her jewels.
The government took all of her
houses.
Yeah, all the things. So she goes to San Francisco to live with Sally Hawkins and get her feet back on the ground and look for some work. And it's the weirdest San Francisco that I've seen in a film since Sweet November.
Do tell.
Well, you know, it's all white people. All white people.
Oh, Woody.
It's... there's no gay people in this San Francisco.
Oh, that's true. I never thought about that.
There's one gay person in Sweet November, but he does drag.
Oh, God.
And it's played by Jason Isaacs.
Yeah.
So, it's Sally Hawkins' ex-husband is Andrew Dice Clay. Her new boyfriend is Bobby Cannavale. And her new boyfriend is Louis C.K. Meanwhile, Cate Blanchett is doing this bizarre thing where she's going to a computer class, like the girls in Mi Vida Loca.
We got to learn computers.
And so that she can learn how to use a computer and be on and get online, and then see about getting her decorator's license on the internet, which I don't think can happen. It's a strange film in terms of Woody Allen's relationship to the real world. And what I think, and what I've given him as a as just the benefit of the doubt.
Right.
I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt that he knows that this person is that disconnected from reality. Mm. That it's a sort of satirical, you know, take on the bubble that rich people live in.
Right.
Where they only see the things they want to see. They only do the things they want to do. And I'm just going to assume that Woody Allen knows that you don't have to go to a computer class. You just have to go into the Genius Bar and buy a laptop, and someone will say, okay, here's what you do. Like, it's that easy.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the thing is that the working class people in this movie, like Sally Hawkins and her cronies, tend to call out Jasmine on her ludicrous stuff. Yes, yes. But nobody ever says boo about the computer class. Like, this makes perfect sense to them as well.
I suppose.
So I don't know that Woody isn't totally on top of what
that is. I'm giving him that. I'm okay. giving him this. What I'm not giving him is the benefit of the doubt that he actually likes human beings anymore. My thesis in my review on movies.com is that Woody Allen hates everyone on the planet now. And he hates Jasmine. And he wants her to suffer. And he allows her to suffer, and he takes some sort of delight in watching her suffer.
I don't know. I think there's, and
I also,
it might be entirely from Cate Blanchett, but I think I felt empathy for this character.
That's where I was going next.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I believe all the empathy and feeling that you get for her, and you do get it.
Uh-huh.
By the end of the movie, you kind of ache for her.
Sure.
By the end of the film, it all comes from her performance.
But he could have edited the film in such a way to diminish that if he hadn't wanted us to feel something for her.
I suppose.
I
still think he's a misanthrope.
Well, to some extent, yes. It's also fascinating that when Alec Baldwin's character says he wants to leave her, like he announces that he's in love with a teenage au pair.
Yes.
It's like, Woody's had that conversation before. I like this movie a lot. I mean, you know, there's a lot of obvious parallels to Streetcar Named Desire, and Cate Blanchett did play Blanche DuBois on Broadway.
Yes.
I think what's weird about it is that certain filmmakers bring a baggage with them to each movie, whether they want to or not. Mm-hmm. I always remember the end of Unforgiven, when Clint Eastwood's character, you know, gets his guns and he goes in to kill Gene Hackman and the other guys, you're supposed to think, oh, this character is now lost beyond redemption. He tried to put this violent life behind him, but now he's giving himself over to his dark side. Oh, this is terrible. But I think that for me and for most audiences, you see Clint Eastwood with a gun and you immediately think, yeah, get him! Kill everyone!
That is kind of what I think.
Yeah. And so I think in a Woody Allen movie, you get this character who is this sort of like jabbering, neurotic, tic-laden.
And who really is losing her sanity.
Who is losing her sanity, and we're inclined to laugh because that's the kind of character he's been doing for decades in a comic context.
Yes.
I mean, I saw this at the premiere, which I hate going to those, but that was the only one I could get into. And, you know, Cate Blanchett was there, and people in the audience were laughing far longer than I think they should have. Like, they should have eventually, they should have picked up early on that, oh, no, this is actually a tragedy.
This is a drama, yeah.
Yeah, this is a drama. But, you know, because, and I think it'd be interesting to see, like, you know, I told you about it, you know, my whole thing with you, if you didn't know that the Bling Ring was a Sofia Coppola movie. I'd love to have a test audience of people seeing Blue Jasmine, not knowing it's a Woody Allen movie.
Yes.
And gauging their response to Blanchett's performance and whatever. I mean, you know, everybody's raving about it, and I think, you know, it's going to be super Oscar bait for her, no question. And she's really good, but the context of knowing it's a Woody Allen movie, you're not quite sure at first how you're supposed to take her or what you're supposed to make of her, you know. But she's really good. I liked her performance a lot. Andrew Dice Clay is so good in this.
He's so good, yeah.
Holy crap.
He's not in it a lot, But he has really significant moments.
Yeah, and a real presence.
Well, he's the only person in the movie that feels like they have come in from some other land besides one constructed by Woody Allen.
Sure.
He is one of the working class characters in the film that you do not laugh at for being sort of a buffoon or a terrible person.
Right. He is genuinely a victim of...
And angry.
Yeah, of Jasmine and her husband's sort of greed and chicanery, and does not let them off the hook for it.
Ever.
While like Sally Hawkins seems to be perfectly willing to let her off the hook constantly, he's carrying that grudge. He's not going to let it go.
And he helps wreck things for her even more as time goes on. So, and when I heard about the casting, I thought, well, that's interesting. Yeah. You know, where's he been all this time?
And why a Woody Allen?
And why a Woody Allen movie? But it works perfectly, and he's really good in it. You're probably now going to see him in more films.
I would love that.
Because of this.
And the fact that he can totally turn off the,
Interestingly enough, keep talking.
He does bring a big slab of, like, Guido to the performance, but never.
But that's what he is.
But exactly. But never in a cartoonish way. More in a, this is a guy, you know, what's his real name? It's like,
I don't know.
It's Andrew something very Steen at the end. You know, it's that guy. It's much, you know, he comes off like you could believe this guy working at the docks or something.
Yeah.
You know? He's very effective. I liked him a lot. Louis C.K. isn't in it much, unfortunately, but I hope that he and Woody Allen collaborate more because I think their careers are on interestingly parallel tracks.
How so?
Well, they started as stand-up comedians. A lot of the stuff that Louis's been doing on the show, Louis is very, I think, Woody Allen inspired to the point where he actually hired Susan Morse as an editor on several episodes.
Yes,
Louis, you know, he made another movie before Pootie Tang.
I forget what it was called. So I have not seen it.
So. I don't know. I think
I can't stop watching Pootie Tang.
Yes, well.
It's so great.
I don't know. I just I see them as having interestingly similar careers, so it would be cool to see them collaborate more. What were you going to say about the Dice Man?
Last night I was at a gallery opening, and I talked to two women who were roughly my age who asked me about this movie in particular. And when I brought up Andrew Dice Clay, they both went, "Ew!" And I thought that was really interesting because... They said, well, how is he? Is he being that? I said, no, because that's a stand-up persona. I mean, you get that, right? And they were like, yeah, but it's just so gross. It's such a gross stand-up persona that, like, even 20 years later, they still hate him for it.
Well, that persona was super sexist and homophobic.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. So I understand that they hate him for it 20 years down the road. But I was... a little surprised because, you know, the film critics that I've talked to about this film, they have, you know, compartmentalized that and put it aside.
Sure.
In favor of, like, well, here's just this man who is an actor. And so it was just an interesting conversation to have where they were really sort of just not having him on any level.
Speaking of people with onstage personas, if you've never gone to YouTube and watched the clip of Larry the Cable Guy before he was Larry the Cable Guy.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That is fascinating.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Doing stand-up with the
Hawaiian shirt.
No, it was like the jacket with the sleeves rolled up.
Oh, kind right. Of thing. Okay, that sort of something stuff. Like that. Yeah, it is so not
and
Larry
mullet,
the Cable
mullet,
Guy.
And, yeah.
Yeah, so it's amazing how that's a character. We forget it's a character because he does it 24/7, but... Larry the Cable Guy is a construct.
Yeah. Larry the Cable Guy is essentially Pee Wee Herman. Like, when he's in public, that's what you see.
Right.
You don't see him being not that character.
Right.
He is always that. It was like, you know, it's like, you know, Minnie Pearl or
Joe Bob
like that.
Briggs.
Yeah. You're always, well, but, you know, you see...
John Bloom does not turn up a lot. It's you mostly, if he's doing something in public, it's Joe Bob Briggs.
Your headphones?
I know, they're shedding plastic things. It's driving me crazy.
Right, but it was hanging off your face.
I need a new pair.
It's like you had food on your face. So this is a good film.
Yeah.
It's
a little overrated already.
It's a big performance by Cate Blanchett. If you don't like that kind of acting, then you're probably not going to enjoy what she does. I think it's one kind of acting that you can do.
Sure, yeah. And I think she, within the parameters of what she's trying to do, she does it. She doesn't go too far with it, I think. I mean, unless you think that kind of performance is inherently too far, that's something else. But if you're going to choose to do this kind of turn, she does it very well.
Yeah.
And stays within the, she colors within the lines, you know.
The film is very hateful. But I think her performance is not.
Yeah.
And so there's that tension between Woody Allen's, you know, sort of heavy stamp and her, you know, empathy courting sort of performance.
Huh. Fair enough.
Yes, very fair.
The fairest of them all.
That's me.
All right. The Wolverine.
Explain.
Okay.
And don't do what you always do where you start rolling out a list of and then and then this guy and then and the blah blah blah, blah, blah whatever, and then you sigh. Don't do that. All right, go.
Always do that.
Oh yeah, you do.
Oh fine.
So I'll be eating some bread with Nutella.
So you're Jackman and he's the Wolverine. No, okay, so there was X-Men Origins Wolverine, which was terrible, and we're all trying to forget it ever happened.
Mm-hmm.
So now Wolverine begins, and Logan, Hugh Jackman, is living alone in the Yukon in a cave, haunted by two things in his nightmares. One, the atomic explosion at Nagasaki, where he was in a Japanese prisoner of war camp, and he saved the life of one of his captors, whatever. And memories of Jean Grey, whom he was forced to kill in X2 before she destroyed humanity.
I'm going to interrupt you for just a second, because every time he wakes up from a new nightmare, his beard is bigger.
True. He dreams of himself as more clean-shaven.
Yeah.
And there's like two of those, you know, wake-ups at the beginning of the movie, and I turned to Dave and I said, this entire movie is going to be him waking up. So he is pulled back into the world when this cool Japanese chick finds him. And she is like, you know, amazing fighter and has Kool-Aid colored hair and stripy tights, and all the cosplay kids are going to be doing her for years. And she has been sent by the Japanese guy who Logan had saved at Nagasaki, who is now dying and wants to say goodbye to him. So he accompanies her to Tokyo. It turns out this guy is now like this hugely successful electronics magnate. And when he gets there, it turns out the guy doesn't want to say goodbye. He wants to relieve Logan of his immortality because Logan hasn't particularly been enjoying it that much of late. But Logan says no.
You're going to eat that last biscuit? That biscuit of immortality? Because if you're not, I'll take it.
I got some jam.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the guy has this, the Japanese guy has this blonde doctor who's clearly up to no good, and a granddaughter who's going to be inheriting the company, and Logan gets pulled into all this sort of corporate intrigue where the Yakuza are trying
Yakuza.
To... and this is the kind of movie where when people are talking to each other, they say things like, The Yakuza, the Japanese mafia. No, you know what? That person's Japanese. They know what the Yakuza
Japanese
is.
Japanese people explaining Yakuza to each other.
You are a Ronin, a samurai without a master. Yeah, I know what a Ronin is. Really clunky exposition. So then
Logan, you really have a doofus character always hanging around Wolverine to go, What's a Ronin? What's a Ronin?
What's a Nubian? So then Logan has to protect the granddaughter because they're all trying to kill her, and this involves love hotels and bullet trains and they had a checklist of cool Japanese stuff.
Everything you liked from Enter the Void.
The bullet train.
You know how much you all loved Enter the Void.
The bullet train fight is pretty amazing. I mean, we've seen fights on tops of trains a million times, but bullet trains go like, what, 400 miles an hour or something?
4,000.
So it's pretty intense. And the evil doctor lady turns out to be a mutant who is going to try and help the Japanese guy steal Logan's mojo or whatever. And she's the worst actress ever. Mm-hmm. I just want to go on record with this. She's terrible. Yeah. She single-handedly kind of sinks this movie for me. I mean, not entirely, but boy, is she awful. She is so direct to DVD, it's not even funny. I'm going to look up her name and shame her publicly.
It's a long Russian name.
It's Svetlana something, because the world needs to know. Svetlana Kodchenkova. She's awful.
Yeah, she's awful.
Oh, she was in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
Well, I guess she's not so awful then,
perhaps,
is she?
Perhaps she didn't speak in that movie.
Maybe she's the January Jones of this of this film.
Of the, as opposed to the one in First Class.
Yeah.
Rila Fukushima plays Yukio, who is the striped tights girl, who is very cool and very intense, and I would like to see her in more movies. And her scenes with Wolverine are the best parts. Overall, this is okay.
Maybe I enjoyed it more than you.
It's
I had a good time.
I think it's perfectly functional. It'd be the sort of movie where if you did it on the cheap and it were a B movie, you know, in the 50s, you'd be like, oh yeah, that, you know, it's like, you know, something like the narrow margin. Like, oh yeah, that was a solid. That was fine. You know, it's nothing great. It doesn't.
Like a mystery noir kind of thing.
Where, yeah.
With a lot of action.
Yeah.
That just happens to star a superhero.
Right. Yeah. The cool thing is, this is a superhero movie that is not about the apocalypse. Like, the.
Thank God.
The stakes are not mankind or the planet. It's just. It's more like, yeah, he's kind of inserted into this action movie about, you know, the sins of the past, or about, you know, corporate chicanery or whatever, and it just happens that, oh, it's also about, you
he's kind of like Magnum PI in a way.
Yeah,
but he has to go around and find out what's going on.
Exactly. Yeah. Except that, but they also want to steal his mutant powers. Yeah. You know, so there's a little bit of that going on. And, you know, definitely sit through the credits, because there's a shawarma that is the best thing in the whole movie and gets you very excited about wherever the X franchise is going. Maybe not the best thing.
It's not the best thing in the whole movie. There's some cool stuff.
There is.
It's got Yakuza battles.
It does.
It got ninjas.
Uh-huh. Oh, sorry, I forgot ninjas.
Ninjas. If the movie has ninjas.
Or as they say in Miami Connection, oh no, ninjas.
If a movie has ninjas, that makes it automatically worth looking at.
What if it's that one with the three ninjas in the amusement park?
I will tell you about that film, because I saw it. I saw that movie back in the day in the early 90s.
With the ASD kids?
With the kids from Aid Services Dallas, back when I lived in Dallas. I'm sorry, back when I lived in Fort Worth. In the early 90s, I was a volunteer at Aid Services Dallas, and there were a bunch of kids who lived there, about 10, 12 kids, whose parents had AIDS. And they lived there with their parents. It was a large residence facility, lots of, you know, services and stuff for people with AIDS. And so I was a volunteer there, and my gig was every Saturday afternoon, I would go and I would get in the 18-seater van. It was a gigantic van.
Did you ever have to parallel park it?
I had to do everything in that thing. And I was good at it, too.
Well, all right.
That's how I learned how to be very perceptive spatially while I drive. It's why I don't drive over curbs and things when I'm trying to take a corner, Alonzo.
Don't even start.
So, anyway, I saw every kid movie from 1991 to 1995 or so, in the 4 years that I was a volunteer there.
Was Slappy and the Stinkers in that period?
Mm-hmm.
That
came later. Yes.
You saw that one?
I saw Slappy and the Stinkers.
Wow.
Yeah. Saw Monkey Trouble. You know, Monkey Trouble's kind of dope.
You like Monkey
Trouble. I saw
Young Thora Birch.
Richie Rich, the Coneheads, the Beverly Hillbillies, Hocus Pocus, that all the 20-somethings love now.
Oh, man, yeah. The millennials are all about Hocus Pocus. I've still never seen them.
Hocus Pocus is rotten, by the way.
Yeah, that's what I hear.
And if you love it and you're in your 20s, you only love it because
it was on
when you were six.
There's not to sidetrack us too far here, but millennial nostalgia.
Yeah.
We're totally getting to that period that I'm the old guy that has no idea. I never watched DuckTales, you know.
So now when
there's some internet meme about it, I'm like, I don't know what we're talking about.
It doesn't matter. You don't have to know what they're talking about. It's for them.
Yes.
It ain't for you.
No, I get it. I'm thinking like that, you know, as excited as
three
I was
ninjas
when the Brady Bunch movie came out, somebody who is now my age is going
at Ninja Mountain or whatever it was called.
It was not Ninja Mountain.
It's also very bad. High Noon at Mega Mountain, I think is what it's called. Yeah.
Doesn't Jen Yamato love that movie?
Yes, Jen Yamato loves that movie. Jen Yamato is very young.
Jen Yamato, who's guested on this show.
And I think, you know, it's funny, every time they show one of these movies at Cinefamily, I always think to myself, I can skip that because I've seen it with actual children.
In its original release.
In its original release, when I was already an adult.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Where was I going with this?
I don't know anymore.
And ninjas make movies.
Any ninjas movies make movies better. They kind of almost always do.
Okay.
This reminded me quite a bit of what I would like a graphic novel or comic book to move like. I had such low expectations for it based on two things.
The previous Wolverine.
The previous Wolverine sucking turds. And the placement in the release calendar. By the time you get to late July, the studios are done. The studios are done by mid-July. Mid-July, they're all looking at their watches going, all right, in 2 weeks we can have an actual vacation. And then
the pause before Oscar season
starts. But in these 2 weeks, I'm still not going to do anything. And so there is this 4 to 6 week period in late summer where they just dump everything. Mm. And this just felt like, oh, it's the last gasp. You know, they didn't want it to have to compete with
Man of Steel,
Superman, or Iron Man 3, or any of that. So they kind of put it back here, knowing somehow that it was going to be a smaller movie.
Right.
And it is a smaller movie. They've moved the goalposts, you know, narratively. And yet, because of those lesser expectations, at least on my part, I was very surprised that it turned out to be all right. Now, I've heard a lot of other critics this week just, you know, bashing it. I'm not that person. I had kind of a good time.
I can't get super enthusiastic in either direction. It was certainly better than I thought it was going to be. There are moments in it that are exciting, but it didn't leave me energized in a way like that it had rewritten the book on how to make these movies.
No.
Or that it was particularly good. It just was not bad. It's fine.
I'm going to do 2 weeks in a row now of something that I claim never to do.
Oh, are you? Okay.
Hang on. Last week it was for
Sam Elliott.
In a positive way.
Yeah.
Where I talked about my childhood mostly unconscious desire for Sam Elliott in life, 1976's Lifeguard.
Right.
But here I'm going to talk about a thing. I'm going to do it. I'm going to objectify a male actor in a negative way.
Go on.
I need Hugh Jackman to sit down for a week's worth of big bowls of pasta. Because the extreme abs are disconcerting. There's a moment I feel like where the ripped, shredded, you know, let's see
the sinewy torso.
Let's see what kind of body modification we can do by virtue of diet and exercise.
Mm.
I understand it, and part of me is fascinated by it in a Cronenbergian sense. But
are the architecture of the flesh?
But as a visual, as a thing that I have to look at for 2 hours, because he very rarely puts on a shirt,
right,
in this film. As a thing that must be observed in the course of this 2 hours,
yeah.
I am not a fan of it. I think everybody looks better with a little butter on them. And this is not a, you know, this is not a fatty lover kind of thing. This is just sort of like what Hollywood does to people, what Hollywood does to actors and their bodies. I find very strange.
Mm.
They do it to women, although that trend seems to be a little bit on the rebound. You're not seeing the emaciated woman so much anymore.
Or as emaciated.
Or as emaciated, I guess. Well, it seems to be happening to men.
Yeah.
And that's very strange, and I don't understand it. And I don't approve.
Well, you know, we've talked about this before. The whole
Having said all of that, Hugh Jackman can do whatever he wants to himself, and I'm not here to body shame anybody.
After a certain
age. And I will not be talking about this sort of thing again.
Okay.
Because I'm done.
Yeah. We've discussed before the whole notion that after a certain age, people are forced to choose between...
Cara o culo.
Cara o culo, exactly. Face or butt, you know. So if you want your face to be pretty, then your body's going to have a little bit of butter on it. And if you want the hard rockin' Madonna arms, you're going to get the hard rockin' Madonna face.
But more than that, you're going to get that weird sort of... I'm veiny and sinewy and
right.
ropey looking and weird.
And so, dead. But so yeah, I think the reason that they turned back from the super emaciated actress was that it was getting them in the face, you know. But I think that men haven't hipped to that fact as quickly yet.
Yeah.
And so you see men, especially God, actors when they've lost a lot of weight really quickly,
yeah.
have that drawn look.
Yes.
It's just kind of disconcerting.
Sunken apple cheek.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know, again, yes, we're not here to body shame, but
but that's what we're doing right now.
We think you would
a little bit.
We think you would look better and you would enjoy the sandwich. that's what we're saying.
Have some pie extra and some cake.
Yes.
Some bread. Really what I'm about is I want everyone to start eating more carbs.
Yes, and maybe take some time off from the P90X, like a few days.
Yeah.
Okay, so
extreme.
That's this week's movies. Let's do some letters because we didn't do them last week.
We're going to do DVDs.
We can do DVDs first, sure.
Let's do them DVDs. I would have reviewed Drug War, the new Johnny Toe movie.
Yes.
But
they sent us an online link and then we expired.
It expired after like 30 seconds. Yeah. We didn't watch it. And it opens in Los Angeles this next week.
Okay.
I'm going to see that. I'm also going to see The Act of Killing.
Ah, okay.
So I'm really excited about that.
I've read mostly good reviews, but one really vociferously anti-review. So
from someone whose opinion matters?
I don't remember now.
We need to find out who's been saying.
And I'm still, now that Outfest is over, I'm still intending to go see Pacific Rim in 2D.
Yes.
To see if I like it any better.
That would be great.
Yes.
My DVD pick this week is Claire Denis' 35 Shots of Rum.
And is it in print?
It is.
Okay.
I chose this, worried that perhaps once in the past I've already chosen it, but even if I have, I'm choosing it again, because you should watch this movie. I chose it for two reasons. One, because I have written a piece for movies.com this week, it is my latest Judgment Dave column, all about directors who do not work in English. As it related to Only God Forgives, which is partly in English and partly in Thai.
And there's a link to that piece on our Facebook page.
And we'll link it again.
Yeah.
Because I'm pushing this piece really hard and I want people to go click on it. It is not standard issue material for movies.com, which, in the words of my editor... our superhero obsessed readership is not really going to care about this article. And I was like, I'm sorry.
So yes, please click on it.
So, anyway, it's about directors not working in English. The number one director on that list is Claire Denis. And I chose this particular movie because it's an example of the softer side of Claire Denis, who is often very sort of uncompromising in her ability to depict the hard lessons of life with people.
Ain't a thing but compromising right on Claire Denis. Sorry. Staring at me on radio doesn't work.
Was the safety pin through the nose not enough for you this week? Is that... Are you going for something unusual this week that I don't know about? No?
I'm the salt under your skin.
You're just flying by the seat of your pants, just tossing stuff against the wall to see if it works. Is that what's going on?
That's how I roll, baby.
Blue Jasmine, I thought, was so relentlessly cruel in a way that didn't feel like anything more than the director's, like I said, hatred of things.
Right.
People. All of them. Everyone. Claire Denis will go down that road too, but you understand that she has an interest in humanity. She wants to see humanity succeed. And the way you know she does is from films like 35 Shots of Rum, which was inspired by Ozu's Late Spring, which is the one about the father and the adult daughter, and she sort of helps take care of him. Mm. This is about a widowed father and his adult daughter who live together, and they have this very, very, very close relationship where she really does sort of tend to him.
Right.
And through the course of the film, they meet other people. He meets a woman. She meets a guy who lives in their building. They have this very sort of closely knit community of friends that are kind of like their family in the building they live in. But really, nothing gets between them. Nothing breaks the bond between father and daughter in this movie. Until, you know, some very sort of subtle life events come along and show both of them that they have to move in their own direction.
Huh.
It's very gentle. It's very quiet. It's very, very intimate. It's very loving. It's a really wonderful, wonderful film about family taking care of each other and friends as family taking care of each other, which is directly the opposite of everything that happens in Blue Jasmine. So, Claire Denis, 35 Shots of Rum is the name of the movie.
Okay.
You must see it.
My DVD pick this week is also inspired by Blue Jasmine, and it is Woody Allen's Another Woman, which I think is probably my favorite of his quote-unquote serious movies. It's about a woman going through therapy and someone else who is listening to the sessions through a vent from another apartment. And it features some of the best performances ever given by Gina Rowlands, and that's saying something, and Mia Farrow. And it is, I think sometimes, you know, I like interiors, but I think he's trying too hard to be Ingmar Bergman in that one.
Yeah.
And there are some other, you know, September I think is kind of a fiasco, but I think Another Woman really works and it's really effective and it shows his range as a filmmaker and that he can do these kind of movies that aren't, funny in the slightest, but have real emotional resonance and, you know, I think stand with anybody else's best dramatic work. So, not one of his better known movies, but if you've never seen Another Woman, that's my recommendation.
It's funny. That's what I tell people about you all the time. I say he's not funny in the slightest, but he has real emotional resonance.
Mm-hmm. Who are these people?
Now you're staring at me on the radio. It's great.
Read letters, clown.
Would you enjoy that I read some letters
would
to you?
Would you? Yes.
A. Alanso and Dave. A-L-A-N-S-O. Oh, no. Ha-ha. I found your podcast a little late, but I've been catching up from episode one because I'm meticulous. Well, I blame the ADD. Alonzo, I have known about your work for a while now, and I like your style and trust your taste. Oh, Dave, I've known about your work a little less longer. I read your book, Exile in Guyville. Think you and I have more in common. More on this later. First, my top 10 list. I had to pare it down to 10, but I think it represents me pretty well. Number 10, Decline of Western Civilization, Part 1 and 2.
Oh, okay.
Okay. He likes to think of this movie as one film in two parts.
Fair enough.
Penelope Spheeris' Opus of the West Coast. The Celluloid Closet.
Oh, definitely.
He said Vito was his runner-up for this one. Mm. Number 8, All Over the Guy.
Hmm.
Directed by Julie Davis. Best gay date movie ever, he says. Mm. Great cast with strong chemistry and some top-notch acting. My runner-up for this is Just One Time.
Mm.
I must say to you, our friend, whose name, wait a second, is, I'm scrolling down to get his name, M.A. Ross.
Mm-hmm. M.A., you need to see more gay movies.
We hate both of those films. And I say we because we have discussed this many times about how much we hate both All Over the Guy and Just One Time.
Indeed.
Although you are right that One Over the Guy, All Over the Guy, is better than Just One Time.
And it does at least have Andrea Martin in it. So, yes. You know, it's not a total loss. There are some okay performances in All Over the Guy, but it's still not a good movie.
Torch Song Trilogy.
Which turns 25 this
year. Does it really?
Yeah, can you believe it?
How could I forget my first? This was one of the first gay films I ever saw. Nice. It was also my first introduction to the Harvey Fierstein. It was my introduction to the Harvey Fierstein, too.
It was mine, unless you count the time that I saw him on 2020. And
I did not see that.
And when they were interviewing him when Torch Song Trilogy was big on Broadway, and he said that every family has a gay person in it. As a son,
that's not a bad. That's not a bad impersonation.
A daughter, a nephew. And my mother flipped out. That was a moment that stayed with me.
Yeah. He says his runner-up for this one is The Hanging Garden.
Oh, good one.
I like The Hanging Garden.
Don't we know somebody who had a song in it?
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
Beth.
Oh, right, yes.
My friend, my dear old. Here we are talking about our dead friends.
People, I know. Yeah.
Another female friend of mine who also died of cancer. And mm-hmm. This happened last year. She was in her 40s. She had a song that was in The Hanging Garden.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's next? Tigerland.
Okay.
Now, all right, let's see. I haven't read what he's got to say about it yet.
It's the Teen Beat Vietnam movie.
I think this is his lifeguard. I'm going to get him. One of Joel Schumacher's better ones, Colin Farrell at his sexiest.
Yeah.
Not only physically sexy, but mentally sexy to boot. The runner-up for this one would be Intermission by John Crowley.
I don't know Intermission.
I don't know that I've seen Intermission.
Yeah, I interviewed Schumacher for The Advocate when Tigerland came out, and I told him that his camera looked at
Colin Farrell's buttocks.
Yes. I said it reminded me of Visconti shooting Alain Delon.
Did he like that?
He kind of, yeah. He was like, well, I mean, I wouldn't put myself in that category, but I can't deny that there's, you know.
My camera was pruriently trained on Colin Farrell's buttocks.
I have to dig up that interview. But yeah, no, he was not averse to the comparison.
Lit with the most rosy of flashlights.
Mm-hmm. And that, whatever happened to Matt Davis?
I don't know.
Besides Blood Rain.
I don't know.
He was going to be the next, like, big hunky blonde for a while.
Why don't you look him up and find out? Okay, so, Akira.
Oh.
Again, another first for me. Saw this one in the theater. The symmetry of the Asian style animation just blows me away. This was hard to pick over Princess Mononoke, Howl's Moving Castle, and Ghost in the Shell. The Descent by Neil Marshall.
Still haven't seen it.
It's really good.
Matt Davis was on Cult.
All right.
And The Vampire Diaries.
Okay.
And Damages.
All right.
So he's working.
All right. The Descent, he says, it's about as scary as I like them. I got to see this one in the theater as well. The undertones, well, it came out like a few years ago. The undertones of this one are obvious, and the original ending on the DVD makes it blatant. My runner-up for this one was The Ring.
Hmm.
3, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. If this one gets me a nick in my knife rating, I don't care. It's funny and sad in real ways, and I like it that way. My runner-up for this one is 4 Rooms.
Oh, God.
I really love Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
I don't, and I understand that people do, but yeah. 4 Rooms.
4 Rooms is pretty bad.
That's terrible.
2, Raising Arizona. Another one I saw in the theater, masterfully shot. I have to laugh from beginning to end because I grew up around people and places just like that. Funny thing, me too. My runner-up for this one was The Hudsucker Proxy.
Excuse me.
His number one film is Urbania.
Well, okay.
Remember that one?
Yeah, totally, with Dan Futterman.
I saw it, and I barely remember it, but I remember liking it.
It's cool. It's not a movie that I love, but I remember it being really interesting, and it was... Because it was weird. They were sort of selling it on the premise that it was... There were all these sort of urban legends in it, but it really wound up being this sort of, like, gay revenge movie, almost.
Hands down my all-time favorite movie. This movie affects me so viscerally, I can only stand to watch it once a year.
Wow.
It draws me in, makes me grin, makes me mad, proud, scared, angry, stabs at my heart with a rusty blade, slowly twists it until I blubber like a baby. In the end, it bandages my wounds and sends me off with a kiss of hope.
Wow. And that's what cinema does, people. One man's I don't remember seeing it is another man's I can only watch it once a year because it's so intense.
Your knife rating is 85%.
Yes.
Because we both hate just all of the guy.
And I'm not giving you Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Yeah.
Okay, yes. 85%.
Thank you, M.A. Ross.
Thank you, M.A., for writing in. You had a long one last week that you were going to read, and then you didn't.
That was it.
No, that one just came.
No, that was also on last week's list.
Oh.
Yeah.
He sent it twice?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Hello, David Alonzo. I just started listening to your podcast again after a brief hiatus related to the birth of my son. I am the lady who wrote the letter about being pregnant at the screening of The Clock not getting a seat.
Ugh.
As much as I thought I'd get a lot of podcast listening done while home and caring for the baby, we don't have any babies, but we
know
family members who do.
Yeah.
I hadn't figured on a complete loss of my ability to concentrate on anything ever. When I went back to work recently, one of the things I was looking forward to was getting back to a linoleum knife-enriched commute.
Oh, thank you.
The first episode I heard was the one where you picked which Mary Tyler Moore Show characters you would be, and when Dave picked Georgette, I remembered why I liked the podcast so much. I may sound like Mr. Grant, but in my heart, I am Georgette. Full of sweetness.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Yes. In light of the whole baby having thing, I wanted to ask you, what would be your picks for the first movie a kid should see?
Hmm.
Obviously, Irreversible.
You're terrible.
Breaking the Waves.
Holy Mountain. No, no, no.
Also, I'm curious about the first movies you both saw. Mine was Bedknobs and Broomsticks, which I don't remember at all. My second one was The Muppet Movie, during which my father had to take me out of the theater because I started howling and crying hysterically when I mistakenly thought the bad guys were going to kill Kermit.
That gets pretty touch and go there for a while.
Yeah.
This
is from Jennifer.
Jennifer.
Yes.
I think the first movie that I remember seeing... It was Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory in its original
release. I think we've talked about this before, yeah, actually.
Although I do remember at some point, I think it was later, like my freakout movie was Pinocchio. Monstro the Whale scared the crap out of me.
Yeah.
What's the first movie a kid should see? I'm tempted to say, like, Ponyo.
Ponyo is great. Is Panda Go Panda a movie?
I was going to say, you should definitely get Panda Go Panda because little kids love Panda Go Panda. That's television, technically.
Is it?
It was a Japanese TV show.
Oh, yeah. I see. All right.
First movie a kid should see. The Red Balloon, maybe? Or is that too slow?
That's too slow for a little tiny.
Yeah.
They're not going to watch that.
That's
for film class.
You're right. Yeah, fair enough. The Wizard of Oz is pretty traumatic.
It is, but it's, it's great.
I mean, yeah, the thing is, like, Willy Wonka and the Wizard of Oz will scare the crap out of your child. But, better than
good.
They should start building that.
Good, yeah.
They should start building that callus,
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think Ponyo would be, or My Neighbor Totoro, for that matter.
My Neighbor Totoro would be really good, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a good starter.
I believe the first movie I remember being taken to was also my freakout movie. And it had nothing to do with the movie. My dad took me to see The Jungle Book.
Mm-hmm.
It came out in 67, so I would have been 3. And I freaked out so hard over a giant, like, 1.5 sheet poster that was in the lobby. Before you ever got up, you had to go into the lobby of the Civic Theater in Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
Uh-huh. Is this the place you took me?
Yeah.
Okay.
When we walked in, if you recall, there was that, it was all done up like a box office and everything.
Right.
It used to, back in the day, it was just a lobby.
Uh-huh.
And it had posters, the big 1.5 sheet size poster, it stalls.
Uh-huh.
And there was some late 60s psychedelic freakout trip movie that, like, the poster was like, wah, like at you,
like one of those like AIP
hand reaching out to like swirl you into the LSD nightmare, you
right,
know?
Right.
And I saw that poster and I immediately began screaming and crying and had to be taken out of the theater. We never got upstairs
to the actual movie.
To the actual Jungle Book.
No. Oh man.
That is actually one of my earliest memories. My earliest memory of actually seeing a movie was with my mother. She took us to see 101 Dalmatians.
Hmm.
And it was at the same theater.
Sure.
That was, you know, that was awesome. What I think a little kid should see first is whatever that psychedelic trip movie was that terrified me.
You're now, terrible.
I'm going to go with you. I think that or, you know.
Ponyo or Totoro?
Yeah, like Ponyo or Totoro. One of those Miyazaki films for little kids.
Yeah.
And that way you'll get them hooked on really great Miyazaki films.
Sure.
As well. That or...
Lilo and Stitch?
Lilo and Stitch is a good one also for little kids.
My DVD pick from a few weeks ago, The Underrated Teacher's Pet.
Or that, or Winnie the Pooh.
Oh, the new Winnie the Pooh movie.
The new Winnie the Pooh
from last year, from two years ago.
Was it 2 years ago or last year?
2 years ago, I think.
It was like from 2011.
Yeah. Oh, God, that would be so good.
It's so good, and it's definitely for very young children.
Yes, that one's lovely. And the it's original, beautiful. The it original is, Disney Winnie the Pooh
can't
short.
Praise that. I can't praise that movie highly enough. It's such so a good. It's a beautiful movie.
Yeah.
And I don't think a lot of people saw it. I don't think it made a ton of money.
It didn't. I think people sort of ignored it. They thought it was going to be too, you know, kiddy, whatever. But no, it's a lovely, lovely movie.
Yeah, so, and it's perfect for little kids. So, yeah.
Yeah, just Winnie the Pooh, 2011.
Yeah. So that's it. All right, thank you, Jennifer. This one is from Wendy. Will you be able to review Cockneys versus Zombies? It's getting a very tiny U.S. release on August 2nd, I think. I'm just hoping you do get to see it because it's a hoot, she says. So she's seen it. I saw it last year at Fantastic Fest, and I really wish it was getting a wider release. Maybe we're getting zombied out.
I hadn't.
I am.
I hadn't planned on watching Cockneys versus
Zombies. I'm getting zombied out.
But
if people say, if enough people who have seen Cockneys versus Zombies, will tell me the same thing.
Yeah, tweet at us at Linoleum Cast.
Yeah, I'll eventually get around to seeing it.
Perhaps we can talk about it on our new, soon-to-be-launched linoleum-knife.com website.
I was fixing to save that discussion until later, but well, let's just talk about it now before I read this last letter. Linoleum-knife.com is coming, 2 weeks, right?
Something like that.
We're about 2 weeks out.
We're very close.
We're really just starting the process of loading it up with content.
Yeah.
But it's designed, it's ready to go. If you go there right now, you'll see practically nothing.
But there's a placeholder.
It's there, and it's fixing to be a thing, and you'll hear
technically
much.
It's linoleum-knife.com.
Hyphen or dash?
A dash is longer.
Is it?
Isn't it? The dash is like used in a sentence. A hyphen is used within a word or name.
Well, what's it going to be on your keyboard then?
A minus sign.
The lowercase minus sign?
Yes.
Yeah. All right. So linoleum, lowercase minus sign, knife.com is coming real soon. How's that?
I think that's even more complicated than saying linoleum-knife.
Well, whatever. All right, last letter. Dear Dave and Alonzo, greetings from my house, where the air is still blistered and stinging from the debate over Only God Forgives. A tense armistice has been reached since I told my girlfriend that her hatred of it will finally allow her to grasp how much I despised The Help. I can't say I got everything I was hoping for from Only God Forgives, but I enjoy being paralyzed with despair by Danish filmmakers. Me too!
So we didn't scorch the air. He and his girlfriend scorched the air. Okay.
I enjoy being paralyzed with despair by Danish filmmakers nearly as much as I enjoy actually enjoying myself. We are bros.
I'm with you on the help, but that's about
it. And I can't say I object to the demand for a return to cool violence in the household. In the interest of domestic peace, I've suggested we watch The Raid every night for the rest of our lives. I think she'll go for that. Or I could really release the tiger and trick her into watching Hanukkah's The Seventh Continent.
Oh, God.
Oh, Alonzo, I must ask, how did Only God Forgives rate on the excess redness scale compared to, say, We Need to Talk About Kevin? I'm a total Kool-Aid swallower. I don't think he meant to have a pun in that for that movie, and I followed your antipathy toward it with glee. Well, hold on, he's okay, not done yet. Right. Appreciated your B. Ruby Rancher interview. Linoleum Knife rules now and forever.
Woo.
That's from Jake. Thank you, Jake.
Thanks, Jake.
We are... No, that's not from Jake.
No.
The next... I'm sorry. That was the penultimate letter.
Ah.
This last letter, I think. Wait, it was from...
Who wrote the letter about Only God Forgives?
I think that was Dan.
Get it right.
I'm going to get it right. I'm pretty sure I'm right. I forgot to put the name on it.
Get it together. Dave White, how long have you been doing this? I give you one responsibility. I hook up all the wires. All you have to do is read the letters, and you can't even get that.
I think it's Dan. Yeah. So,
Dan, if that's your name. Winding Refn drenches a lot of scenes in red, which is fine.
Yeah.
What was annoying about... The red in We Need to Talk About Kevin is that it's the Where's Waldo in each scene where you have to sort of look for it, and there's going to be one plate or one, you know, Rothko piece on the wall or a pair of shoes or a wagon or something.
Dan, it is from Dan.
It is, okay.
Yeah.
So she keeps making you look for it. At least the red in Only God Forgives is all up in this piece.
Only God Forgives is terrific.
I'm not going to have this argument with you again.
Dan and I, we understand cinema.
That's fine.
I suggest that you and I watch The Raid every night for the rest of our lives. I think he's got a great idea on that.
If the girlfriend agrees to that, he should marry her.
All right, this next one is from Jake, and this is the last one.
Okay.
David Alonzo, greetings from Portsmouth, England, the name of the town where my movie theater was when I was a kid, but not in England, in New England.
In Old Hampshire.
A friend introduced me to your show a few months ago. I've gone back and listened to a lot of the episodes.
Thank you.
And Dave has climbed to number 3. I'm reading this letter, Colt. Climbed to number 3 on my favorite voices list. Overtaking Patrick Warburton.
Wow.
Thank you, Jake. Leaving Christopher Walken in the top spot and Adam West at number 2.
So I'm number 3. That's a good list.
Yeah.
Yeah, you wouldn't like Dave White's voice so much if he was always telling you to do the dishes. Trust me on that one.
Here's how it sounds. Why don't you get in there and wash a dish? Is that a fairly accurate representation?
Now imagine that every night for the rest of your life after you're finished watching The Raid.
Look, this is not me bossing around the maid, all right?
Mm.
I'm the cook in this house. Mm. I'm the real good cook who's making you all kinds of delicious treats.
It's true. Dave made...
All the time.
Dave made duck legs over roasted potatoes this week.
Damn right. Yeah.
So good.
Yeah.
Because the potatoes were all brown and crispy, but they were soaking up duck fat.
That's right.
Duck fat!
Now you get in there and you wash a dish.
Yeah, fine. Go on. More letter, please. Mr. Special Voice.
Jake would like to be knifed.
Okay.
Although I know I cannot achieve 100% knife because of Alonzo.
I'm strict but fair.
Because his number one film... Although he says it's in no particular order. Number 1 is Pulp Fiction.
Oh, you're going down.
Get it out of the way. I know it hurts my score. The Wizard of Oz.
Mm-hmm.
Alien.
Mm-hmm.
Donnie Darko.
Mm-hmm.
The Godfather.
Mm-hmm.
Clay Pigeons. I haven't seen it.
God.
I know it is.
Yeah,
in
with,
the 90s.
With, is it Joaquin Phoenix?
I think
Vince
so, yeah.
Vince Vaughn and like Janine Garofalo. I never saw it either.
Yeah. Mrs. Doubtfire.
Really? Really?
You know, I like Mrs. Doubtfire.
Now, the thing is, British people should know how awful that accent is. I don't know why they're like...
I think that's why they like
maybe. It. Okay, carry on. What else?
Rear Window.
Okay.
Shaun of the Dead.
Okay.
I think this next selection is going to make you give up a chunk of your minus 10% because of Pulp Fiction.
All right, let's see. What do you got?
Educating Rita.
Ooh, good yeah. one.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Yeah. With Michael Caine and Julie Walters.
Yeah, he's still losing 10 for Pulp
Fiction. He's only losing 5 because I like Pulp Fiction. Whatever. Dude, you're a 95% knife. I'm giving you Clay Pigeons because I've never seen it.
I guess I'll give you Clay Pigeons. Well, I'm not giving him Mrs. Doubtfire's. That's a 90.
All right. I like Mrs. Doubtfire, too. Dude looks like a lady. Oh,
gosh. Who knew?
I hope to attain at least 75% knife. Well, you got 90.
There you go. There you go.
You got 90. Thanks for the show, says Jake. P.S. If you could give a shout out to The Wasp, that is the friend that introduced me to the show. I think it would make his week. Thanks again, Jake.
Well, hello, Wasp.
Hello, The Wasp. What are you?
Does Wasp as an acronym mean the same thing in England as it does here?
Do you F like a beast?
I wasn't thinking of that acronym.
When I hear Wasp, that's the first thing I think of.
I was thinking white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, but then I guess there would be no point to have a term for that in England since that's all they make over there, right?
That's not true.
I'm not saying that's all, not all that lives there. I'm just saying that's all they make.
That's also not true.
Well, okay, fair enough, but still.
Everything you just said is wrong.
But they invented that, is what I'm saying.
Sure. They did. All right, now, that is all the letters that were waiting to be
really,
read.
Really? We are caught up?
We are completely caught up. Now, here's why I'm saying this. If somehow in the past, you know, month or two or however long, you sent us a letter that did not get read and you have listened to every show, that means somehow in the transferring of my old laptop to my new laptop, something got lost.
So you have failed again.
Perhaps I have failed. It is entirely possible. If I have failed, resend that letter and we will get it read. Unless we hate it. There's always that, you know. Unless you're calling us, unless you're writing us to tell us how much we suck.
Oh, you'd read that.
I would read that.
You would totally read that.
I would read that. Otherwise, we're done.
Woohoo.
Done.
It's been lovely, as always. So yeah, linoleum-knife.com coming soon. Keep an eye out. And in the meantime, check out our friends in the podcast universe. The Comedy Couch with Dennis Hensley and Tony Tripoli, Cooking with Malcolm Ingram, Fat Guys at the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Throwing Shade, Team Jack, The Schmoes Know, The B-Movies Podcast, Film Spotting SVU, Pod Crash with That Chris Gore, Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this program on iTunes for free, and if you want to leave us a review on iTunes, that would be really great because it helps people find the show. You can stream this program at Stitcher Radio or at thelounge.com. Please like our Facebook page. Follow us at Twitter at LinoleumCast. You can check into the show at getglue.com. I said the email address wrong last week, so if you sent it to the wrong place and it bounced back to you,
my apologies. Someone doesn't know our email address like they should.
I was in a hurry. That's LinoleumPodcast.
I'll just like at gmail.com.
Do you know our email address?
That ain't my job to know.
Do you know it? Can you say it right now?
No.
Can you say it even though I just said it?
No.
So, okay. Shut it then.
No.
LinoleumPodcast@gmail.com. Come back next week. We'll do this again.
Goodbye.